Before we get started, we do have two cases set for oral argument this afternoon. And we're going to take a little break between the two cases. And I understand that council have checked in, and Mr. Hampton, you're splitting your time 10 and 10. Okay, perfect. So before we call the case, I'll introduce the panel that we have. To my left is Justice Brian Walker. To my right is Justice Dana Womack, and I'm Elizabeth Kerr. So unless there are any housekeeping matters to take up first, I'll ask the clerk to call the case.
May it please the court, for the next 20 minutes, you're going to hear me use words like nothing, nowhere, anything, other absolutist phrases, sweeping words like that, because the affidavit that is at issue in this case is itself sweeping. The sentence that is at the heart of this case from the Fourth Amendment states that no warrant shall issue, no warrant shall issue, but upon probable cause, upon oath and affirmation, particularly describing the place to be searched. None of these requirements of the Fourth Amendment were met. This is the worst affidavit that I think any court will ever see. It's worse than the famous cases that were later modified by Illinois v. Gates, which is Aguilar and Spinelli. And the reason is that there is no particularity stated anywhere in here. And when you hear the state argue, keep in mind the particularized facts that they argued to the trial court were particularized facts that support Mr. Staley's arrest. They never connect why they can get inside these devices that are at issue. Before I get further into that, I really want to flag the court. If you simply read the state's brief, you might think that the standard of review of a search warrant affidavit is that probable, this is from page 31, they do this repeatedly through the state's brief, starting on page 31, and they say probable cause arises from a reasonable belief that certain items may be useful as evidence of a crime. That is not the standard. Emphatically, that is not the standard. The standard for search warrants is the one stated in my brief. Let me tell you where that language is taken. It's exactly two cases, Texas versus Brown, and a Fort Worth case, Hardin. They're very similar. Neither one of those cases has anything to do with a search warrant. Neither case has anything to do with an affidavit to support a search warrant. I'll tell you what happened in both of those cases because they're extremely similar. Texas versus Brown, a police officer stops, traffic stop, he looks down, and in plain view, he sees a little green balloon. He knows that is how heroin is exchanged. The issue in Texas versus Brown was not anything to do with a search at all. It was whether the officer could seize that item, that balloon. The Hardin case from Fort Worth, same thing, almost identical facts, except it was a syringe. Same issue. Could the officer seize that item? Answer, yes. Nothing to do with this case. That's the standard for when an officer and what he can seize when he is in plain view and sees something. That's an instrument.
Before you go on, I just want to make sure that I understand the scope of the appellate complaint, because it's my understanding that in the trial court, at the January 13th suppression hearing, the focus was really, and the motion that was filed on January 12th that was the subject of that hearing, seemed to really focus solely on the GoPro video from the Mac Mini. But I take it from your briefing that you're complaining about cell phone,
yes,
other stuff.
Yes, I'm complaining about the cell phone and the GoPro and the text messages.
Does it matter that when the text messages were introduced into evidence that defense counsel said no objection?
No, I believe that she was referring to, let me back up. Before she says no objection, two things have happened. One is extensive conversation with the trial court about a running objection. And he makes it clear, so this means I don't have to stand up or do any of that. He also says, Mark Daniel, who's the lead counsel, defense counsel, and he makes it clear that, in fact, he says something like, well, you're not going to hear us say no objection, because he's been around long enough that he knows that is kryptonite to an appellate complaint.
But she said no objection.
Exactly. So the second thing,
the other defense
besides
counsel,
that, is the you got to look at that in context. She says no objection to an exhibit, and leading up to that exhibit, it is only being introduced conditionally under Rule 103, I think it is, of the Rules of Evidence. When he connects it up, she says no objection. She has no objection because there's nothing objectionable. The prosecutor connected that item up, and so of course she doesn't have an objection to that. So that's what she's talking about if you look at that in context. And to return to your question, yes, there was a lot of talk about the GoPro because the GoPro is one of the most amazingly bad items of evidence. I was just over lunch talking to Mark Daniel about it, and we both agreed. We've been around. We've done plenty of capital cases, and it's just that awful. And so, yeah, the GoPro would obviously be the centerpiece. However, his motion was much broader
than
that.
Well, the January 12th motion, I mean, I'm looking at it because I really do want to make sure that we're focusing on the right things. So the January 12th motion says that the defense wanted to suppress, including but not limited to, the Apple Mac Mini. But then in the prayer for relief, it says, please grant the motion and suppress evidence seized from the Apple Mac Mini. And it doesn't say, and other stuff too. Why are we not limited to the four corners of this motion?
Well, first, there were multiple motions.
But they were withdrawn.
But still open for consideration by the trial court, and that's all you need to preserve a complaint for appellate review. Everybody understood during the extensive briefing and argument between the counsel that you were talking about all of the devices, and they used that word, devices, as in plural, and that includes everything that I've listed. So it's preserved for appeal if the trial court understands what's happening and the prosecution understands that that's what's at issue. And he had to have known that because he argued it. So I think this is perfectly preserved. I don't think it's limited to just the GoPro.
You were mentioning the standard and the standard that the state's relying on and how those had to do with just seizure issues, correct? I mean,
that's right.
Right before Justice Kerr asked a question. Are you conceding in this case that they had a right to seize these items? They just didn't have a right to search them?
No, I'm not. I don't think they had the right to seize them either. That's just it's simply that the focus at trial was on the search. It really wasn't on the seizure. But no, in order to seize those items, there's several problems with the seizure of those items, but they match the same problems with the search, which is a lack of probable cause, a lack of particularity, the use of boilerplate language that was condemned by the Court of Criminal Appeals, and the sweeping any and all devices, which has been, you look at my brief, that language is condemned all across the country, beginning with the U.S. Supreme Court and Riley.
Well, you know, I mean, law enforcement tactics differ depending on if there's a potential crime that could take place and a crime that has already taken place. I mean, and so what detectives are going to do in a situation where there's a deceased victim is going to be a little bit different than if maybe they're trying to figure out if somebody's selling drugs.
And I agree.
And so when there's a deceased victim, you know, it's pretty pro forma for detectives to start seizing items that they think may be connected to the crime itself. You concede that much.
Well, they did the right thing and seized with a warrant those items that they identified at the scene. That was the best part of this shoddy investigation. That was the one thing they did correctly. This is unusual in that the incompetence is unusual. You just don't see this. There are plenty of competent homicide detectives who know how to handle this. And this was negligence at its worst.
Thank you. Your time is up.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you.
10 minutes goes fast. We'll hear from the state.
May it please the court. I'm John Gillespie, the criminal district attorney of Wichita County. This court should affirm because the facts in the affidavit provided the magistrate a substantial basis for issuance of the warrant. This case hinges on the nature of the crime detailed in the affidavit, a key Texas law, and a fundamental reality of modern life. First, the nature of the crime. This was a child abuse murder. The affidavit detailed these facts. The scene of the crime was Staley's house, where the toddler victim was found dead, covered in blood, next to his crib with blood inside the crib. After the murder, Staley did not console the mother or go near the dead child, which evidenced a suspicious state of mind. The context of this child abuse murder occurred in a domestic household arrangement where the toddler victim and his mother were living at Staley's house for over 2 months. They were in a volatile dating relationship. The toddler victim received facial bruising from a prior incident of child abuse when he was in Staley's exclusive care 5 weeks before the murder, and a digital depiction of the prior child abuse existed. The mother had taken a photo of the facial bruising, which then after the murder she forwarded to detectives. This was far from boilerplate. These ample facts implicated a key Texas law, Article 3836, which authorizes prosecutors to provide relationship and state of mind evidence in murder trials.
But how does that relate to a search warrant, though?
Certainly. Your Honor, prior relationship is evidence. If prosecutors can offer it, then detectives can search for it. And if detectives can search for it, magistrates can authorize, if they have a substantial basis, the search for that evidence. It defines the aperture of what evidence is. In a one-off crime, like the crime in Baldwin that we'll get to in a minute, you have very limited 3836, next to none evidence to be searched for. But the nature of this crime, this ongoing domestic relationship, 3836 states that is evidence that we can offer and that the magistrate can authorize a search for.
Let me ask you this. Do you concede this isn't the best warrant affidavit you've probably seen in your career? Do you at least admit that much?
I probably wouldn't make that concession, Your Honor. There's a lot there that I think you have to look at from the lens. He sets out he's a crimes against children's detective with 14 years of experience, and then he details extensive facts. I've seen a lot of warrants that don't have nearly the amount of detail and facts that this one contains in it. He details the relationship. He details the prior episode of abuse. He details where they were living in the same household. He details the fact that they move out right before and then move right back in, which shows a volatile relationship. He alleges they're in a dating relationship. These are all specific, particularized facts that many warrants simply do not have. So,
but doesn't a warrant affidavit still need to have some sort of nexus alleged between? I mean, you know, I understand the crib, the sheet, all that stuff, totally legit. But is there sort of, to put it in Daubert terms, I guess, kind of an analytical gap between saying, you know, yes, this is my background, this is what I've had experience in, and then saying any and all electronic devices.
Well, I would agree with you if that's what that warrant detailed, but that's not what's there. He says, this is my background, and as a crimes against children detective, here are the facts that I'm alleging. Why? Because he knows that domestic child abuse murders are different than other types of murders.
Right. But it would have been a simple thing to have included detail. I mean, for instance, I know how you've characterized what happened to the child during the when he got the bruise on his head, but it doesn't say in this affidavit that was a result of anything Staley had done. It doesn't allege that there was child abuse on that occasion. So, I mean, I would think that it would be, I don't know, seems a little troubling that the affidavit didn't say something as simple as, in my experience, when people are in a volatile dating relationship, you know, a lot of times there's electronics in the house and they'll communicate this way. Wouldn't that have been a better practice?
It might have been a better practice. I'm certain you could write a better warrant than the detective, and I could too, because we're lawyers. But the case law says that the standard, we understand they're not lawyers when they write these affidavits. It's the magistrate's job to apply the law to the facts that are alleged. The magistrate would apply the 3836 relationship law, that is the law in the state of Texas, that this affidavit implicates. And so for those reasons, you know, I know that there are ways that you could put a topic sentence in that the court is talking about, but it would be clear to a magistrate that when you're alleging a dating relationship in the digital age, and this, the first fact in that affidavit is October 11th, 2018. That's the context for which this is being presented. And then he alleges a dating relationship. Does a dating relationship that involves a household relationship involve kissing? Of course. We know what a dating relationship is by the common use of it. In this day and age, it also involves a fair probability of electronic communications. And
now, but you have a deceased young victim, correct? I mean, this wasn't a domestic abuse case pertaining to the paramour. It's a young child.
Justice Walker, I don't think the law makes that distinction, though, in the domestic household. We've obtained many protective orders for children who are abused out of domestic relationships. Well, so I think when you're looking at the aperture of what constitutes evidence, if there is an ongoing relationship, 3836 says that is evidence.
Yeah, and let me ask you this. Are you insinuating that because 3836 applies to the scenario that there doesn't have to be particularity in the warrant affidavit?
That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying it's the magistrate's job to look at the experience and the facts, and I went over those facts that he alleges. Those are specific facts. They're not boilerplate. And the magistrate applies the law to that and says, yes, there would be a nexus between searching for electronic devices at the site of the homicide, at the site of the ongoing domestic relationship, and there's a fair probability that those devices would contain documentation of Staley's relationship with the toddler who was living in his house that he had cared for 5 weeks before. And regardless of the description in the affidavit, it still says facial bruising that the mother takes a photo of, and then she later forwards it to detectives. So there is this ongoing duration of a relationship that's existing in the Staley home with Staley caring for the child. And so the case law says the magistrate's not a babe in the woods. The detective doesn't have to say, we live in a digital age. He alleges dating relationship, and he alleges these household facts. I would suggest, unless somebody's Amish, a dating relationship, a domestic household arrangement, is going to have documentation electronically between the two parties that are caring for the toddler in the house. 3836 says that is evidence in a child abuse, in a murder prosecution. And so it's the magistrate's job to apply the law to those facts, it's the detective's job to lay out those facts.
Well, I've got a question. Do you at least agree that the any and all language in both the affidavit and the warrant was inappropriate?
I don't agree with that because we cite case law. It's about the electronic devices that are in the home. And we cite case law that says that they're not required. The appellant concedes that the home is going to contain electronic devices. And we cite case law in our brief that cites we don't have to detail the serial number of the devices to be searched. I think that in the context of that, it was specific enough that it's limited to the Staley house to devices that exist in that house. So I think that I would refer the court to our footnote in the brief. I don't have those cases on the top of my mind, but we don't have to specify the serial number for each device.
But do you think it's okay to use the any and all language in the warrant? Because shouldn't the magistrate have, it looked like this was cut and paste from the affidavit. The exact same laundry list. And shouldn't the magistrate have applied the law and eliminated the any and all language?
The magistrate could have required more specificity there. But I think the point is, I think the cases that we cite in our brief are, the magistrate was clear that they're authorizing search for electronic devices that are in the Staley home. Why? Because the ongoing relationship was in the Staley home. Now, they could have described some devices that maybe they knew of and some that they didn't, but the case law says that you don't have to describe with particularity the specific device to be seized. So I don't think that any law in that language was inappropriate. The scope of the search, I believe, is informed by fundamental reality of modern life. We live in the digital age. Relationships, dating relationships in the digital age, occur with electronic communication. Is there a fair probability that parties in a dating relationship are going to communicate electronically? Of course. Is there a fair probability that parties in a domestic household arrangement with a toddler are going to communicate electronically about the needs of the toddler in the household? Of course. Was there a fair probability that Staley and the mother had communicated about the facial bruising? The affidavit alleges she's at work, he's caring for the child. That communication, if it existed, would be relevant and admissible in a murder prosecution.
But wouldn't that be something that that would be on her phone? I mean, texts back and forth about that. I mean, I'm having a hard time understanding why a necessarily a computer or the Mac Mini or whatever in a household would necessarily, without more explanation than an affidavit, be likely to show that sort of evidence that you're talking about.
Or a GoPro camera.
Right.
Well, certainly. I'll get to the GoPro in just a second. I want to field Justice Kerr's question first. As to the communications, people communicate on their computer, tablets, on their computers. They text on computer. They communicate electronically there. Texts are not the only exclusive way that they would communicate. Secondly, she was a member of that household for over 2 months. The affidavit alleges that the devices can be synced, and so on computers that exist in the house. So her device and his device, because you said back and forth, he would be one of the parties initiating that communication about the toddler. There's a fair probability that would be located on electronic devices in the house. As to the GoPro, the device alleges this, it details this depiction of the facial bruising that she takes a photo of at the time and then later forwards to detectives. That's the word that's used. Forward in this age means it means that it's capable of being digitally forward. That's the common parlance for the word forward. She's a member of that household. She takes that photo while she is a member of that household. It's a search of devices in that household. It authorizes a search for the depictions of child abuse, and that would be a visual depiction of child abuse. Searching for that photo, is it backed up? Is it on his phone? Is it on his Mac Mini? Proving the authenticity of that would authorize the scope of that search. And what did they find? They found a visual depiction of child abuse, several visual depictions.
And essentially, he would have been looking to corroborate what she communicated.
That's correct. And that would be admissible evidence under 3836, and she's a member of that household. That's why those facts are so very important that are alleged in the affidavit. I want to, with that foundation, I'm going to address 4 points briefly. First, the constitutional preference for a warrant entitles the magistrate's determination to great deference. The standard of review strongly supports affirmance. Second, appellant's reliance on Baldwin is misplaced because the nature of that crime involves strangers, and that affidavit had no facts implicating 3836. Third, Foreman is the analogous recent Court of Criminal Appeals case that supports a magistrate's authority to give full weight to reasonable inferences from facts in the affidavit to reach electronic devices at a crime scene. This magistrate had the same authority. And fourth, this court's published Upchurch decision is dispositive of both harm and preservation. Upchurch precludes harm because the jury heard other evidence of Staley's previous abuse of the toddler victim. Upchurch forecloses preservation of the cell phone evidence because Staley created ambiguity as to the scope of the running objection and whether he intended to abandon it by his trial conduct. First, the standard strongly supports affirmance. The Constitution prefers a warrant, and as such, the magistrate's determination is entitled to great deference. As this court knows, the role of a reviewing court, whether it be the district judge at the suppression hearing or this court, is to give great deference to that warrant and determine if there was a substantial basis, a factual nexus for what he authorized to be searched. I've been over the facts that show that nexus. It's not to substitute the judgment of the reviewing court. Probable cause exists when the totality of the facts presented along with the reasonable inferences, and that's important, reasonable inferences, from those facts establish a fair probability that a crime has occurred and that useful evidence will be found. 3836 is Texas law. It says that that type of evidence in murder prosecutions is admissible and it's useful by the law of the state of Texas. And we're dealing with fair probabilities. We're not dealing with beyond a reasonable doubt or even a preponderance of the evidence. Juries convict people on circumstantial inferences beyond a reasonable doubt all the time. There's case law from this court and from all the courts in Texas that says circumstantial evidence can be as strong as direct evidence. If the nexus in a beyond a reasonable doubt can be based on circumstantial inference and circumstantial evidence, then the nexus on a fair probability certainly can as well, because fair probability is a far lower standard. Second, appellant's reliance on Baldwin is misplaced because the nature of that crime involves strangers and that affidavit had no facts implicating 3836 evidence. It was a stranger home invasion. There was no evidence about state of mind. We have evidence about state of mind here. There was no evidence about any duration of the relationship of the parties there for the simple fact they were strangers. I would encourage the court to look at Baldwin. They print the affidavit there. You will find not a single fact of any ongoing relationship that would implicate 3836 in Baldwin, unlike the cases that the facts that we went here. The device was not found at the scene of the crime in Baldwin, and they relied solely upon the detective's training and experience. They said that you've got to have that plus particularized facts. Here we have the training and experience that I talked about, plus the mountain of particularized facts that I went over in my opening.
If this wasn't a 3836 case, do you think that there would be a problem?
It would depend on the nature of the crime. Because there are other cases besides murder prosecutions where an ongoing relationship evidence, such as sexual abuse cases, where that could be implicated there. So it's going to look at the nature of the case. But what we are dealing here is a murder investigation, a murder prosecution, and we have a statute directly on point that says this ongoing relationship evidence is admissible and useful evidence. From those facts, there's a fair probability of finding that evidence on electronic devices at the scene of the ongoing relationship, at the scene of the murder, at the Staley house, with the facts that are alleged.
Is there anything else in the instant case that differentiates what we're dealing with here as opposed to the Baldwin case?
Yes. We also have the digital depiction, the photo that she took. She's a member of the household, and she later forwards it to detectives. There's nothing like that in Baldwin. And you don't take any fact, as the court knows, in isolation. You must give the great weight to all of them. But that is another fact that we have that implicates 3836 that simply doesn't exist in Baldwin. For the probabilities are also radically different. When you have a stranger home invasion with no evidence of any prior relationship, there's a slim to none and slim just left town chance of finding any 3836 evidence in that type of a crime that you had in Baldwin. It's very different when you're dealing with a child abuse homicide with a suspected incident of previous abuse. Appellant concedes in his brief that there was suspicious evidence of prior abuse there. So you have a pattern of two incidents, Staley's the keeper and this ongoing relationship of the parties. The probabilities are far different. The probabilities was Was the toddler victim welcomed in Staley's home? Was Staley equipped to meet his needs? What were the arrangements for his care? What these critical moments of moving in and out, the mother and the toddler victim immediately before the murder, the abuse of the suspected incident of abuse 5 weeks before when Staley's keeping him, there's a fair probability of finding those things and a factual nexus to the devices. In Fernandez, I would draw the court's attention to Fernandez. Massachusetts distinguished their Baldwin-type case of strangers from an ongoing domestic-type arrangement, and they said there's a fair probability that the devices in the home would document the ongoing nature of that relationship, and they distinguished their case from their Baldwin-type case. I want to mention briefly Foreman. It's the analogous Court of Criminal Appeals case. You had two gentlemen who were tortured in an auto body shop. The affidavit authorized the search for surveillance equipment and video. The affidavit didn't mention surveillance equipment and video. But the Court of Criminal Appeals in 2020 looked at the affidavit and they found that was authorized to search for that because there was a substantial basis, because the totality of facts, giving that deference and the great weight to all of the facts alleged, the description of the business, the movable inventory, the fact that the window had been tinted so that the business owner had taken one security measure and might take another, that looking at the totality of all of that, that there was a fair probability there would be security system and footage. That's an electronic device at a crime scene giving weight to the facts in the affidavit. If this court gives the same weight to those particularized facts that I went over about the 3836 evidence, I believe the court will reach the same decision that apply the Foreman case to our set of facts. If I have no other questions, I would request respectfully the court affirm the decision of the lower court.
Thank you very much.
I want to do a couple of clarifications. We talked earlier about what the devices were, and there are three, and it's the GoPro, it's the cell phone, and it's the laptop, and I didn't say laptop earlier. The other is, what was the scope of the debate about what was admissible and what wasn't? The clerk's record on page 1458, the prosecution itself states, defendant seeks the suppression of evidence found on electronic devices that were seized at his house that day. So that is what defines the scope. It's not limited to just the GoPro. It's limited to electronic devices.
And that's a statement that's taken out of that first motion to suppress. Is that?
No, that's out of their brief.
Oh, it's out, okay.
They filed after.
I'm just trying to clarify.
Yes, sir. Yeah. After the last hearing.
Okay.
The main hearing, really. The previous one was, three pages.
You're referring to the state's brief responding to the January 12th suppression motion,
it's the second, it's the last motion. There was confusion. They had to clarify it. Judge Young asked
so which came first? Just looking at the sequence of things in the clerk's record, it looks like what I'm referring to as the GoPro suppression motion, or the Mac Mini, that came earlier than the state's brief responding to the sufficiency of the warrant.
Well, there was a motion in December, and I think there were two others that were filed as well. And the judge had taken them under consideration. The defense withdrew the second one, which had to do with the second search.
The Franks hearing?
Yes.
Yeah, right.
That's it. So,
The state ended referring to, and I can't remember the name of the case, but it's not the Baldwin case. It's the one that they say is probably more.
Foreman.
Foreman, and what do you have to say in response to that?
I want to talk about Foreman. Foreman was a case in which the affidavit didn't say surveillance, okay? It said everything but that. The judge read that affidavit and gave and ordered the seizure of surveillance devices. On appeal, the defendant argued, hey, he didn't ever say surveillance devices. What is great about Foreman, which is the court itself, it's unanimous, but it is also, they acknowledge and they call it a close case. Nevertheless, at the, I agree with it. On page 166 of that opinion, that is where they consider the totality of circumstances as stated in the affidavit in Foreman. And it's, and I love how they do the analysis. What they do is they take a fact that is in the affidavit and make a reasonable inference that the magistrate could have made. And so there is a list of it. You've got a business, it's an auto shop, and then one of the key things is they've already got a security measure. They've got tinted windows, they've got bars on the windows, the cash is exchanged there. Is it reasonable to infer with all of these other surveillance things that there might be surveillance devices? I'd say yes, I'd agree with that.
But you wouldn't say that the same inference could be drawn from the fact that a few weeks before this child was murdered, he has a big bruise on his head while he's in Mr. Staley's care.
Exactly, because what I was emphasizing on Foreman is they don't make a second inference. They don't do inference stacking. I infer from this fact, and then now that I've inferred, I'm going to do an inference on my inference. They don't do that. That is the way to analyze it. Foreman is a case in my favor. That's the way you should analyze and not engage in post hoc, frankly, speculation.
Well, help me here. Okay. What's the first inference and what's the second inference? What would be?
In Foreman?
No, what you just said, that the inference stacking.
Yeah, that's the problem. All of the inferences that you can take from what is essentially three paragraphs, and the one that's emphasized by the state today, I want to address. But the inferences lead you to very strong probable cause for Mr. Staley's arrest. We are a long way from probable cause to search the devices. Everything they've said do two things. One is, and they point out, I conceded it. Well, of course I do. Do people own computers and cell phones? Yeah, I think that's a pretty good, you can make that inference, a magistrate can. Where does that get you? The importance of Baldwin is it tells you the limit of that. You've got to have a connection to get inside of a cell phone or inside of a computer. That's what's lacking. What they've emphasized today was the paragraph here is one, she discovered while at work one day, months earlier, she discovered bruising. She was told by Mr. Staley that the child fell off a bed and hit his head. Amber took a photo at the time and she forwarded it to Detective Nelson. Detective Nelson observed bruising on on the child's face. Okay, where are we at in the search of cell phones and laptops?
Well, their argument is that, the inference is that there's gonna be a photo that matches that photo and that can corroborate that, obviously.
Well, that's quite a stretch, and it's not.
But that's not really an inference on an inference. I mean, that's. I'd say that's just an inference. Let's break it down like this. Let me change the subject a little bit. I mean, your whole case really hinges on particularity, and that's the problem. And of course, we all know a terrible thing happened in this case, and we also know that. There's a decedent, and we know that law enforcement just inevitably is going to think we need to collect evidence and we need to analyze this evidence to see if that evidence connects to this crime. And so, without a constitution, we wouldn't be here, but obviously we do. We have these constitutional restraints. And in this particular case, it depends on whether or not there was particularity or not. And of course, they mention cases that say that they don't have to be so particular that they have to list serial numbers. And yet, you're saying that this wasn't particular enough. Would it have to be a situation where every item is listed? I mean, essentially, where the detective goes and he sees, okay, well, there's a GoPro, there's a Mac Mini. Now I need to go back to the magistrate and I need to actually say there's a pink Mac Mini or a red Mac Mini or a yellow GoPro. And in order to pass constitutional muster in your mind,
that is exactly how the search warrant affidavits look like. That's exactly how they're worded. They have a reason to get inside there. They've got a basis for it. And short of that,
there's a problem?
Yes, there sure is. You've got to be particular before you can get in there, because a cell phone, just like the Court of Criminal Appeals has recognized, as has the Supreme Court in Riley, that it's not the Fourth Amendment's all about the search of people's homes. Home is your castle. Well, your cell phone is your medicine cabinet, your financial data. It is far beyond what anybody ever imagined. So before you can get into that, yes, you absolutely have to have particularity, and detectives do it every day.
Well, that leads me to something I'm glad you reminded me I was going to ask about. So your second issue mentions Articles 18.02 and 5 and 18.04, and you seem to be arguing that because Baldwin was talked about at the suppression hearing and Baldwin itself dealt with those particular aspects of searching a cell phone, that was sufficient to preserve a complaint about searching the cell phone.
Right.
So help me with the idea that just referring to a particular case subsumes within it everything that's possibly relevant within that case.
Zillander and Langston are your two preservation cases from the Court of Criminal Appeals, and I quote them in my reply brief because they're very clear. It's very well established that so long as the person, the defendant, is making a complaint that is clear enough to the trial court at a time when the trial court can do something about it, then it is preserved for appellate review.
Here, but the suppression motion didn't even talk about the cell phone. That doesn't matter?
I don't think so at all. When you've got attached to that motion, the case itself telling you, and it is the case, the first case, the only case by the Court of Criminal Appeals that interprets this relatively new statute. So what else are we talking about? And they do talk about it. Baldwin is repeatedly discussed orally to the trial court and in writing. I don't see how that's not preserved.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Your time is up. Appreciate it. So I want to thank all counsel for your oral argument. It's been very, very helpful. And with that, your case is submitted, and we will take a break until 2:30. Thank you.